Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Ian Bailey from Zwiesel Glass Manufacturers. How are you, Ian?
Very well, thank you.
We're going to be talking a wee bit about Zwiesel and glass manufacturing. You're a very large producer for the restaurant trade.
Yes, we're predominantly servicing the catering trade, and we are the global market leader with the world's top hotels and restaurants by a long shot.
So what does that mean? Does that mean you sell mainly to hotels and restaurants? Can the public buy your glasses?
The public can also buy the glasses normally through mail order, because we don't view retail as a priority for the brand.
If you think about it, then, say, a glass manufacturer such as Riedel, who focus mainly on the public, and you guys mainly on the trade.
So we're a mirror image of one another.
Okay, they do a wee bit of trade, but yeah. Okay, fantastic. We're going to talk a wee bit about you guys, and we're also going to talk a wee bit about sort of the things that a restaurant will use to make a decision on a glass shape. And next week, hopefully, we're going to talk a wee bit more about bowl shapes and all that sort of technical stuff about glassware. But let's start off with Zwiesel.
Zwiesel. It means the meeting of two rivers.
The meeting? Oh, really? Is it the meeting of two rivers? Is that where you started?
So we're still in Zwiesel. So that's a town in Bavaria, very close to the Czech border. And there are two rivers there, hence Zwiesel.
Ah, okay. When did it start?
In 1872. The company was founded originally to make flat plate glass, in fact, stained glass windows. Mm-hmm. So most of the cathedrals in South America and North America to this time have Zwiesel stained glass windows in them.
Oh, fantastic. And do you get maintenance jobs? We had my local church had a windows blown in World War II by you guys.
Aha.
And they haven't been replaced. Maybe we should send you guys a bill for it.
And they probably did.
But they haven't been replaced. So would you, if one of your old windows is broken, would you get it replaced?
We have absolutely nothing to do with that side of the glass industry any longer.
Okay, so it's all about just stemware and...
Yes, from 1924 onwards, we were focused on stemware and barware.
Oh, okay. Sorry about the comment.
No, it's fine, actually. It's quite humorous. We don't mind. Just be careful in case we invade Poland again.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, for sure. Well, you're English, aren't you? You live in Derby, you were saying earlier, so it won't be you.
Yeah. And it doesn't bother any of us. We have jokes about it.
Oh, good.
Back in Bavaria, so that's fine.
So you started making glassware in 1924. Was it wine glasses at that point, or?
Yeah, wine glasses and barware. So, you know, stemless barware for whiskies and things like that.
Is that a big interest for spirits?
The barware.
Yeah.
The barware side, yes, is big, because if you think, you know, every single hotel, most restaurants have a bar element. Whiskey is an incredibly popular drink, and all soft drinks frequently get served in tumblers.
Ah, okay. Yeah, no, that makes sense. We're going to focus in on the wine side of things. What was the next big step in terms of from a history? Was it a family business originally, or...?
It didn't start as a family business. It was an individual entrepreneur who founded the original business. But in 1927, Zwiesel joined Schott Group, Carl Zeiss.
Famous for their lenses, aren't they? They're very big glass, famous.
Basically, all the advanced technology glass that's been invented has come from Schott Group or Carl Zeiss. Mm-hmm. And the reason for our company joining was to survive hyperinflation in Germany.
Yep.
And we were with Schott Group from 1927 and through until 1999. Mm-hmm. When the company left, there was a management buyout, and we're now an independent company, still with our links to Schott Group and Carl Zeiss, but focused on crystal glass.
What would you say wine glasses versus spirits glasses versus miscellaneous other glassware?
I would say 80% of the turnover is actually in wine glasses.
Okay. Well, that's quite good, isn't it? When you're selling glasses, 1924, joined Carl Zeiss. 1990, you separated from Carl Zeiss, effectively. What happened in between? Anything important happened in between?
Well, the key things are that, first of all, obviously, in 1945, at the end of the war, the Schott Group got split between East and West.
Yep.
The Americans got to the headquarters of Schott Group first at Jena, rounded up all the glass experts and shipped them back to Zwiesel. So Zwiesel, from 1947 until 1960, was the headquarters of Schott Group in the West.
I actually heard a BBC documentary about the reunification of Carl Zeiss or Schott Group.
Right.
It was very interesting about how the two sides had their own views on the world and how they had to come together. But I digress a wee bit. Okay.
Okay. So, but basically from 1960 onwards, we could focus back on crystal glass.
Yep.
And we introduced in 1962 the world's first automated production line for crystal glass stemware. And ever since that date, we have led the world in crystal glass technology.
Okay. So all crystal glass isn't hand blown these days. Is it machine blown?
Most of it is now machine made, but there's still a significant element of mouth blown production.
I saw how bottles were made. I went to an Owen, Illinois glass manufacturing for wine bottles a wee while ago, and they used molds and then blew this glass shape into the mold.
Okay.
Is that how you guys make it, or is it more...
We make our glasses in two parts. So the bowl, we blow into a mold.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing to understand there is that as we blow the glass into the mold, the glass never, ever touches the sides of the mold.
Oh, really?
Because air gets trapped between.
Uh-huh.
So it's molded in air, effectively.
Yeah.
But the stem and the foot we make as one piece, and that is pressed.
Yep.
And then we join the two pieces together on the production line.
Okay, you're saying before we got into the interview that you'd done some work with designers as well. What was the background there?
Well, the design side of the industry is very interesting. If we first of all start off with the wine side of the industry, for many, many years, there's been a growing desire to create one glass that will do every single wine.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ironies is our main competitor actually inverted that movement to create many different designs for many different wines. And we also work very, very closely with sommeliers. So, for instance, Schottswiesel is the glass of choice with the German Sommelier Society and the Austrian Sommelier Society. And many of the world's top wine competitions like Concours Mondial or the International Wine Challenge or the San Francisco Chronicle Wine Challenge. But there are other elements that affect glass design. So we work very closely in the catering trade with regards to handling, which is the reason why we've ended up with the most durable crystal glass in the world. And also with impact, because quite often hotels and restaurants are looking for glasses that have impact on the table, and that's more of a priority to them than how the glass actually works with wine.
So what are the pressures when someone's selecting a glass? What sort of things are they looking for? What are the trade-offs?
Well, with the restaurant and the catering trade, the first thing they look for is how distinctive the glass will be, especially at the top end, and we tend to sell mostly into 5-star and 4-star hotels. And the reason for that is that glass is the third most memorable thing in a restaurant.
Is it? What's the first two?
Right. Well, the first one is obviously the quality of the food and the drink, because if that's not up to standard, yep, people will complain. The second thing is the ambience of the restaurant and the quality of the service that you mm-hmm. get. But the third thing is the glass, for some very good reasons.
Which are?
The first one is that when you go into the restaurant, the first thing you normally see is the glass, because it stands proud on the table and it glitters, and that always attracts the eye. The second thing is that when people sit at the table, they normally have a drink before they eat a meal, which means everyone handles the glass and gets to see everyone else handling the glass. And the next point is, of course, glass is one of only two things on the table that will go into the customer's mouth. So mm-hmm. quality is very important there. And it's the only thing on the table used for serving that can actually affect aroma and taste.
Okay. All right. That's part of the appreciation, I suppose. When you turn up at a restaurant, you look at a glassware, you look at the room. Because I've noticed when we're running tastings, for example, you go into a room, a hotel room, and a lot of hotel rooms actually look pretty ugly before they're dressed. And once you put some white tablecloths down, you put out your glasses and set the room. The room actually looks really nice afterwards. And it's partly that glittering glass, I think.
Yes, the glittering off. Catches the eye. There's another intriguing element to this, which is whilst people consciously may not notice differences in quality in glass, unconsciously they do. And in marketing, there's a thing called physical evidence. So the brain looks for physical evidence of quality. So, for example, if you go to a restaurant and you see wine on the restaurant wine list, say at £60, £100 plus, you unconsciously expect to have some form of quality in the glass that comes with that wine.
Yep.
And the restaurants that understand this quite often actually have two different sets of glassware. One that goes on the table normally, and then when an expensive wine is offered, out comes another one, because it's part of the confirmation that you're special for choosing that wine.
Okay. Obviously I'm not going to the right restaurants, and I'm certainly not spending the right amount of money on the wine. I tend to spend expensive wine at home.
Give it time.
Yeah. Okay, so there's that whole perception of quality coming through. But once you get the glass in your hand, you know, how do people notice that quality?
There's lots of elements for perception. One of the crudest used to be that, you know, if you ping the bowl and it rings, you know that you've got crystal glass.
Yeah, I normally bang my head because you can do that, and it's bing, and it.
All right.
You can do that. Well, I've got hardly any hair, so it works quite well with me.
Well, of course, with our glasses, if as long as they're empty, you can bang them on the side of the table.
Are they quite strong?
Yes, incredibly strong.
Okay.
However, they will still break, because otherwise we'd go out of business.
And scratch, yep, for sure. Okay, so handling a glass, what are the things that people notice when they're handling a glass? What are the trade-offs that a restaurant or a function company might think about when they're investing in the glasses?
Okay, well, there are two aspects to actually handling the glass. If we look at the customer first, so the customer, it's the sensuous nature of the glass that tends to register on their minds. So, for example, we have one range called Diva, where we actually have the stem moving inwards and outwards. So as you run your finger up and down, you can actually feel that movement.
Yeah, yeah.
They tend to like larger bowl shapes, and I'm very sorry to say that the larger the bowl shape, the more people think the wine tastes better. Part of that association is the fact that a bigger glass is presumed to be more expensive.
Okay.
Another part is the fact that it helps the wine to breathe and develop more.
Yep.
But both of those elements are actually working. But if we look at it from the point of view of the restaurant and the hotel, handling's a very different issue there, because what they're concerned about is minimizing breakage in moving that glass from back of house to front of house.
Yep.
And then back again, and ease of cleaning and polishing.
We spent a 10 quid a glass, and they lasted about 6 months.
Which is shocking.
Well, they keep breaking. We're heavy users of glass. Maybe they lasted a year, but they're gone. So in the end, I'll end up going down to IKEA and buying some nice shaped crystal glasses. And I think we've broken one in 4 years. So
I'm saying on strength of glass, it's always awkward. There was an attempt within the glass industry to develop tests to measure strength. So for instance, we developed a test where we smashed 189 grams stainless steel balls into the rims and the bowls of the glass. At Zwiesel, we drop our glasses onto steel plates and find the height at which they'll break. We turn the glass in sand to find out if it will scratch.
Mm-hmm.
We view the glass through UV light to see if there's any tension in the glass. And we also flex the stems. So we actually hold the glass in position, and then we pull the bowl to find out how far the stem will flex before it snaps. But those are all of our in-house tests, and the attempt to get those agreed as standard in the industry was not successful, because manufacturers whose glasses failed the test didn't want to support the tests.
Fair enough.
So actually in the European Union, there's only one universal test that is recognized for glass durability, and that's the dishwasher test.
Okay.
How many dishwasher cycles, that's domestic dishwasher cycles, a glass will survive. And if we take the case of soda lime glass, which is pub glass, the type of glass you encounter in the pub, most of that starts to fail at 1,500 dishwasher cycles.
Yep.
And by that I mean it loses some of its luster.
Yeah, yeah.
And its glow, it doesn't break as such.
Well, that's quite a lot though.
But Tritan Crystal, which is crystal glass, so it's actually a better quality glass, at 3,000 dishwasher cycles, is completely unmarked. And no one yet knows the upper limit of our glass.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's interesting. People talk about glass fading or becoming
milky or cloudy.
Yeah, exactly. And not shiny anyway.
Yes.
And we always just use hot water in a tub and hand polish all our glasses afterwards. So we don't really come across any problems with that. And we discourage our team from dishwashing their glasses just because of that risk of them fading. We just use normal ISO glasses. They're probably made out of soda lime. Is that right?
Yes, these are soda lime ISO glasses.
If you just use normal hot water, nothing else in it, normal soda lime glasses, will they discolor?
No, they should not.
The
thing that creates cloudiness and loss of luster is the astringent qualities of either the dishwasher powder or the liquid. Mm-hmm. And lead crystal, for example, is particularly prone to this because the lead actually compromises the strength of the glass.
Yep.
And therefore it scratches very easily. So the cloudiness is micro scratches across the surface of the glass.
Sure. And what did you say your glasses were made out of?
Our glasses are made with titanium and zirconium.
Okay.
So on the Vickers scale, the surface of our glass is actually harder than steel.
I don't know the Vickers scale, but I'll believe you. It's quite strong.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So let's get on back to the functionality of them. Do restaurants look for tall stems or short stems? And what are the decisions they use in determining that?
There are aesthetic and practical reasons for choosing stems. So you'll find a lot of the top hotels will quite often look for taller stems because it has more impact.
Mm-hmm.
But for instance, if you look at banqueting in the hotel, they quite often look for shorter stems to reduce breakage from glasses being knocked over on when being carried on trays, for example.
I break a lot of stems at home. You know, you just feel it and they just shatter into pieces. Always quite dangerous. Sometimes you feel like you're going to stab yourself in the hand if you're cleaning a glass and the stem snaps.
Well, stems can snap for a number of reasons. Obviously, normally there's some form of kinetic pressure applied to the stem to snap it. But one of the important things to reduce stem breakage is never, ever cross stems when you're carrying glasses.
Cross them?
Never cross them.
Oh, so you carry two and you just have them touching each other.
Because when the stems rub together,
yep,
you create what we call chatter marks on the stem. And then these are micro scratches. You can't see them with your eye, but we can see them under the microscope. And they actually compromise the strength of the stem and make it more likely to snap.
Okay. The other thing that we find with our glasses is if I'm cleaning ISO glasses and I'm polishing the inside, which is a great job, but I've got a big hands and we stick a dishcloth in there, a tablecloth to polish it up. And you'll actually hear it crack down the side of the glass. It won't necessarily shatter, but you can see a crack forming there. And is that because I've got big fat hands? I'm trying to get a thumb in there, or what's going on there?
Well, this is a very brief preview, so I'm not saying this is what happens every time. But if you have a crack in the glass that runs down from the rim,
yep,
it almost certainly started with some form of chip at the rim.
They don't look like they're chipped.
That weakened the glass. It can be a very small piece of damage that actually started it. But if it runs down from the rim,
yep,
it's nearly always that is the cause. However, if you get a crack that runs around the bowl in a perfect straight line, that's normally a sign of tension in the glass and then thermal shock. So heating the glass up or cooling it down converts that tension into a crack.
Oh, okay. That's if you get a really super old bottle of wine with an old cork, they score it and then they heat the top up, don't they?
And it snaps off.
And it snaps off. I've seen videos of people doing that with really super old bottles of wine where they just know the cork's not going to come out cleanly.
Yes.
Okay, excellent. There seems to be three types of glass then. There seems to be soda lime, lead crystal, and titanium crystal. Is that how it works? Is that the three areas?
Right, slight variation there. On crystal glass, there's three areas of crystal glass, basically. So you have lead crystal, and in lead crystal, you can divide it into two areas. So historically, there was a thing called full lead crystal, which was 30% plus lead oxide.
Mm-hmm.
Very rare today, because the problem with lead is it's toxic.
Yeah, yeah. Ask any old Roman emperor.
Yes. And modern lead crystal tends to be 24%. Which is still toxic. Now, I need to be careful here when I talk about being toxic. If you drink wine from a lead crystal glass, you'd probably have to hold it to your lips for about 100 years before enough lead leached out of the glass to cause you any harm.
Yep.
So that isn't the particular problem. The problem with lead oxide and barium oxide in glass is at the point of manufacture and the point of disposal, when lead escapes into the atmosphere or into the water courses.
Okay.
And basically every year or across every year, the regulations on the use of lead increase. By the way, do you know why they ever added lead
Shine it, makes it shinier.
To crystallize.
Makes it really
that
glisten.
Was the main reason the trade liked to tell people, because it does enhance the glass's shine in candlelight.
Yep.
But there were two other key reasons. One of the major problems in making clear crystal glass is to actually make it perfectly. And the defect, the seconds rate in manufacture, used to be incredibly high. And to hide those defects, they used to cut the glass to hide the defects. So that's actually partly the origin of cut crystal. So cut crystal was seconds, not firsts. But what they found was if they added lead to the mix, you can control the melt of the glass at far lower temperatures, so you get less risk of air, and therefore air bubbles. And you soften the glass, so it's easier to cut.
Oh, okay.
So you got less breakage when you were cutting it.
Oh, interesting. Oops. Almost dropped the glass in.
Then you get what we would call generic crystal glasses. So these are crystal glasses that have developed since World War II, which use different mixes of metal oxide. So it could be that they're using barium, which is a less expensive metal oxide to lead, and therefore it reduces the cost for the manufacturer. It could be that they're using magnesium, zirconium. There are all sorts of aluminium. There are all sorts of different metal oxides. And we call them generic because they all have different mixes and some still have some lead oxide in them.
Would you call them lead crystal, or would they just be crystal?
To be proper lead crystal, you want to be 24% plus yep. lead oxide. You can have other generic crystal glasses which have lead in them but don't have 24%.
Mm-hmm.
But the key thing to understand is that most of the generic crystal glasses were developed by manufacturers to reduce their costs.
Yep.
And therefore to improve their profitability.
Sure.
In the case of our crystal glass, it's titanium and zirconium, which makes it the most durable crystal glass. And that was developed specifically because of demand from the industry for reduced breakage. And we have two types. So our mouthblown is titanium crystalware. And if you're not one of our mouthblown titanium glasses over on a wooden table, 9 times out of 10, it will just bounce. And it's dishwasher safe,
mm-hmm.
even though it's mouthblown.
Yep.
But if you take our machine-made glass, we call it Tretan crystal, which is all patented, and that's because it's not just titanium, it's also heat-tempered. And we heat-temper the glass at the rim, where the bowl joins the stem, and where the stem joins the foot.
When you say heat-treated, you mean you let it cool down, then you heat it back up, and then let it cool again down
yep.
quickly. And that normally reduces any internal stresses, isn't it? That's normally what heat-tempering is all about, is reducing stresses.
That's correct.
I know it from chocolate making.
Oh, well done.
they temper chocolate to do the similar sort yes. of thing. Well, I actually change the crystals, but anyway, we won't worry about that too much.
And we treat those areas because of how glasses get used in the catering trade. So when they're put into the washing racks, they're normally thrown in, and the most exposed pieces of the glass are those areas that we temper.
Okay. Why don't you temper the whole thing?
Because we'd have to change the entire production process to do that. And we already operate at far higher temperatures than anyone else in the world.
And is the temperature an important thing, is it?
The temperature is important because it's also a contributor to the strength of the glass. So we operate at 1,400 degrees centigrade.
Mm-hmm.
The factory is quite a sight, by the way, because it operates 24 hours a day.
Yeah, I mentioned it would do. Molten glass, once it gets heated up, takes forever to heat up and cool down.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent there, Ian. I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.